In a civilized society, the means are all important. It may seem unimportant momentarily that one person's guilt was established through questionable means, but in the sweep of history, a nation that accepts indiscriminate practices as normal has no claim to a position of moral leadership. We talk a lot about what we're fighting for in the war on terror. We talk a lot about how proud we are of being Canadian, but exactly what does that mean? This week, Jennifer Stoddart, Canada's Privacy Commissioner, released a powerful and damning report calling on more powers to protect citizens from the private and public intrusion. The question we're going to examine for the first hour of today's show is personal privacy and open government. Just how free are we? We have privacy rights that are invaded in three ways and under three excuses. First, the government, with their multitude of inspectors on tobacco, on language, on taxes, says those are necessary to infringe on our private lives for the good of the state. What the state gives us in return, we're not so sure. The second element, however, is the flip side of how government policies protect elected officials. Canada, basically, on federal and provincial levels, is run by star chamber tribunals that allows elected representatives to hide behind appointed committees, appointed commissions answerable to no one, while the elected officials hide from the public itself and don't even allow the public to call them. And the public is stigmatized for fear that they'll be called a lobbyist, even a normal everyday citizen with a grievance. The third aspect that's troubling is that while the best of our young people are taking the fight in the war on terror over there, as they should be, we have compromises of what they are fighting for right here at home. Troubling elements like security certificates that allow governments to lock up people on mere suspicion without charges simply because they are persons of interest. We're going to examine all these three aspects. First with Ms. Stoddart, then with constitutional expert Julius Gray. New York Times Washington correspondent Scott Shane will be joining us on the perils of unrestricted state security privilege. And he's going to be talking about the importance of preemptive intelligence rather than preventive controls. We're going to move on in our second hour to discuss two other subjects. Rights are rights are rights, or are they? We're going to have Brent Tyler on in his challenge to Quebec's Bill 104 that again is curtailing language rights. And we're going to be talking about Kyoto. Is there anything really to it, or is it a scam for emissions trading? With a very special guest, Dr. Timothy Ball, who is Canada's first PhD in climatology. We're going to start with our first guest on personal privacy and open government. How free are we? In just a moment. And as you listen to these interviews, please call in because this affects you and this affects you every day. Every time a phone rings and every time there's a knock on the door. Because if we have to live our lives weighing every action, every communication, every human contact, wondering what agents of the state might find out about it, how they would analyze it, judge it, tamper with it, and somehow use it to our detriment, we can never say that we are truly free. And beyond that, there is the more subtle and immeasurable effect upon so many to adhere to the most smug biases in order to avoid any government oversight or inquiry or intrusion. We'll be back with you right after this.
Montreal, our next guest is one of the few government officials that we have almost unrestrained respect for. And one of the reasons is straight talk. Jennifer Stoddart was appointed Canada's Privacy Commissioner in 2003. She's in the third year of a seven-year term. She was formerly the president of the Commission d'accès à l'information du Québec, law professor, and she has taken many courageous stands, none more courageous and none more important than the stand she took in a report that was tabled this past week on privacy laws and what we need to protect the public. The Privacy Act, her office stated, is an outdated law that leaves the Office of the Privacy Commissioner of Canada virtually powerless to protect the privacy rights of Canadians relating to information collected, used, and disclosed by the federal government. Ms. Stoddart?
Yes, hello.
Those are your words. Welcome to this program. What's our greatest challenge?
Our challenge is to bring protection of privacy rights up to date with a more modern and a more realistic conception of what is happening to our rights and how, as individuals and citizens, we need to control them.
What's the greater danger? Ella, the advances, you make the point in your report that really no changes since 1983, but of course electronics have advanced tremendously. Is it the electronic oversight, or is it the new sharing of information between departments and between levels of government? Which is the greater threat?
Well, you know, I think it's the cumulative effect of both. Because we have the technology, we think it makes things simpler and easier to exchange all this information instantly, emails, you know, marketing and so on and so on. But that means that there's accumulated amounts of personal information being held by the government on you, being traded around, being sent to various uses and entities that you probably can't even dream of when you originally gave this information to the government.
Certain things that we know about are very troublesome, and I'll just point out two that will highlight both those aspects that we've just talked about. One is the decision of governments, both federal and several provincial ones, to start sharing revenue information both with other departments and with other levels of government. Revenue files used to be private and for the use of the revenue department. The second was the proposal done by the Liberal government just before the last election that called on all internet telephony and email providers to keep all our files forever on their own mainframe computers, and to release them to the government at simple request without probable cause, 8,000 files at a time.
Mm-hmm.
How do we protect ourselves against both those kind of things?
Well, I'll take the first one, the tax information. As far as I know, sharing of tax information has been going on for quite a long time. But your example proves the point that because in most places it's so opaque, I'd say with the exception of Quebec, where because of Quebec's very democratic legal structure, you can actually track where the personal information is going through the administrative agreements. This has been going on for about a generation, but I guess some Canadians still think when they give income, you know, information to the Income Tax Department, it stays there. It doesn't, and the Supreme Court has said that this is perfectly legal. So this is one of the reasons why I'm saying we need a law that ensures transparency so people understand what the consequences of giving their information to the government are, where it's going, what they can do about it, when there's a glitch, do they have any real rights to have this corrected, do they have any real rights if there's a big screw-up and, you know, possibly they could get damages. They don't have those possibilities now, and I think this is serious.
In terms of that kind of transparency, the Quebec government actually only started doing this a year and a half ago, made a big deal of the fact that they needed legislation to start sharing information down with municipalities. And their excuse was we needed to collect more tax revenue. They ended up collecting only $10 million more in tax revenue after they started breaching the privacy of the revenue files than they collected the year before. I don't know what it is on the federal level.
Well, as I said, it's a lot harder to track overall, but basically in Quebec, the system for file sharing has been set up for a long time, but it takes the approval of the Quebec Access to Information Commission. And that's a pretty unique system in Canada. All I'm doing, and I'm sure the Quebec Commission would be happy to talk to you about that more, but I'm just saying that this is one example of the fact that it is possible to give greater transparency to citizens about where their information is going. If I could come back to the other example you used, I think you're referring to what has been called lawful access legislation.
Yes, under the guise of national security.
Right, and international cybercrime, which is, of course, a real problem. This has been floating around, and there's been consultations by the Justice Department on this for about 2 or 3 years now. I would expect to see very soon some legislation brought down on this. So this is something in which I'm going to have quite a bit to say because, in fact, from what we understand, it will ask and require internet service providers and telcos to keep records of your information, your phone information, your
emails,
your traffic information, and so on for quite long periods of time.
Is there a danger that we're going to be a society that's going to mirror what we seek to destroy? In other words, We won't know what we're trying to protect. If we want to be a free democratic society, we need to protect individual rights while fighting all those nasty things out there in the world, and we won't be able to recognize ourselves after the fight is over?
Well, I'm very concerned about that. I think we have to remind ourselves very regularly what these rights are, what freedom is, what liberty is, because privacy is a very important ingredient of liberty. If I think I'm being checked, watched, and surveyed all the time, I'm going to alter my behavior. And that's what can happen in our societies if we think we're always being surveyed all the time. We have to remember what our basic principles are, and this is why we need things like regular parliamentary reviews of the Anti-Terrorism Act. You know, that review isn't finished now.
Correct, and I don't think there's a sunset clause in there.
6 years, there hasn't been any report on it. We need regular reporting by government departments that deal with national security issues, like Public Service and Public Security and Emergency Preparedness Canada, on how they're dealing with personal information. We need a parliamentary committee to oversee this, so we have representatives of you and me somewhere in the structure going, okay, but how does this affect ordinary Canadians? Chase the terrorists, yes, chase the national security threats, but let's not lose sight of why we're doing it and how it's affecting the ordinary citizens.
Right. Jennifer Stoddart, we'll be right back with you after this. We're back with Jennifer Stoddart, Privacy Commissioner for Canada. Ms. Stoddart, you said in our previous segment that we have to be very, very careful about what we're trying to do and balance our security needs versus what we are as a nation and not lose sight of it. Louis Brandeis once said, all civilized systems of law confer upon man as against their governments the right to be let alone, the most comprehensive of rights and the most valued by civilized men. Canada has been criticized for the past 5 years by the United Nations as being one of the most invasive in terms of privacy rights in the G7. How do we roll that back?
Well,
how can the public help you?
The public, thank you. Well, thank you for that question. I would love to tell you. The public can go to their local MP and say, as they are saying already in the polls that we are conducting, that Canadians have never been more concerned about their privacy rights, that I think 88%, we mentioned that figure, of Canadians want an overhaul and updating of their privacy laws. They want real privacy rights. If the government is misusing their privacy, their personal information, they want a right to have it corrected. They want a right of damages. If you go to your local MP and saying, what is the government doing about privacy rights? We talk about accountability. Accountability is the big buzzword in Ottawa now. It's the main thing on the agenda, but we've forgotten about accountability for personal information. This is Privacy Act reform. So I think there's a big role for citizens in pushing this.
You make the distinction in your report between the two documents that govern your duties, both the Personal Information Protection and Electronic Documents Act and the Privacy Act.
Mm-hmm.
PIPEDA limits the private sector's collection, use, or disclosure of an individual's personal information. What would you like to see upgraded in that on the private sector?
Well, I think the private sector should... PIPEDA is coming into... up for a parliamentary review this fall.
Right.
And there's several things that I think could be changed in PIPEDA. We're going to bring out a major paper on that in about a month. So maybe I can say, look at our website. We're going to look at a mixture of increased protection for Canadians' rights. For example, in times of data spills, shouldn't we be notified of a data spill that might increase our chances of being a victim of identity theft, for example? To a lot of housekeeping improvements as any new legislation, some of it doesn't work so well for the user groups, so there'll be a lot of, technical changes, I think, like that. That is a whole other subject, PIPEDA reform, and so maybe I can say again for those interested, look at our website.
Which is PRIVCOM, PRIVCOM.GC.CA.
Exactly.
Final question. Great concern about biometric cards on your part, both for the private and the public sector?
Concern generally about any privacy-invasive uses of new technology. Technology itself can be good and bad. Technology can help us. It can even help privacy, and it can hinder privacy. So as we move to increasing use of biometrics, what we have to do is make sure that this biometric technology is implanted so that you have maximum personal control and you don't have all your biometrics being compiled into databases that are then going to be hacked, and you're going to lose your biometric identifiers, because then you've really got a problem.
And between the cards and the CSE, the Communication Security Establishment, monitoring of so much of our cell phones and land calls, I think they're up to 35%, if I'm not mistaken?
Could be. I'm not familiar with the exact number, but they have pretty wide powers to monitor traffic between Canadians and international traffic.
Is there a firewall between CSE and the Privacy Commissioner's office in terms of your ability,
well,
if there's
a
complaint?
There's quite a few firewalls around CSE, but we did do an audit of them as I think about 5 years ago. 5 or 10 years ago, before I was Privacy Commissioner. We have met with them on privacy impact assessments, so I can say that the Canadian Security Establishment is not unfamiliar with privacy concepts, but they're clearly in the national security domain. But we do have jurisdiction over them. We have jurisdiction over CSIS, the RCMP exempt banks, and the last time we did an audit about 10 years ago, we had the number of exempt banks reduced, that is exempt from the privacy legislation. So we work fairly closely with the RCMP that submit its new information sharing agreements to us for what's called privacy impact assessments, that is to see how at the design stage you can make programs as privacy friendly as possible. So yes, we have the National Security Establishment on our radar screen.
Jennifer Stoddard, thanks for taking the time to be with us. Thanks for your service to all of us in the public. And I just want our listeners to know, PRIVCOM, PRIVCOM.gc.ca, is the website of the Privacy Commissioner, and it's the House of Commons Standing Committee on Access to Information, Privacy, and Ethics. You can have your voice. As Ms. Stoddard said, call your MP, get on the web, look who are members of the Standing Committee, so you can have your voice and your say. Jennifer Stoddard, thanks very much again.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Some pretty startling stuff from the Canada's Privacy Commissioner. I want to bring it home to a very, very personal level. What she's talking about is the amount of stuff that's collected on us. And what's happened just in the past 18 months, we used to have a status quo in this country, federal and provincially, for example, on your revenue information. It would remain with the Revenue Department, would not be shared with any other departments, would not be shared with any other levels of government. Quebec, over the past 18 months, has begun to share revenue information both with other departments and with local municipalities in an effort, they say, to recapture certain taxes that were missing. Well, the amount of taxes they recovered in the past year were only about $8 million more than they recovered the year before, but with massive breaches of our privacy and of what information that was supposed to be secret. We've had the federal government, before the last election, tabling the proposal that all Internet telephony and email providers have to keep all our records on their mainframe computers forever and give them over to state security authority on simple request with a probable cause, 8,000 people at a time. These are grievous breaches of what we normally considered our private domains. And right after this, we're going to be talking to Julius Gray about where the first defense of our private rights should come from. We'll be back with you right after this. Montreal, we want to hear from you. We want to hear where you're ticked off, how much invasion of your personal space is government doing at various levels. And to discuss the broader implications of this right now is constitutional expert Julius Gray. Julius, welcome back.
Hi.
How are you?
Okay.
During the conversation with Jennifer Stoddard, basically three areas of concern in privacy protection were identified. The first, of course, is the general programs, the general mandates, the general powers that government has taken on in the name of national security, everything from security certificates to the proposals last November to have persons of interest wear electronic anklets. Secondly, the personal invasion, the invasion of people on a very individual and personal levels, whether they be tobacco inspectors, language inspectors, the sharing of revenue information that wasn't there before, the monitoring of personal phone calls by the Communication Security Establishment. The third element, however, is the reverse privacy element of how government protects itself, how so much of government, how so many of our elected representatives now hide behind either star chamber tribunals responsible to no one or administrative tribunals to which they've delegated their power so that the private citizen can't even call their elected representative. If they call,
they're smeared with sometimes with the brush of being a lobbyist, and many times they're just afraid to call. And if they call, the elected representatives can't do anything because they've already abdicated so much government authority. Which of these three areas is cries out most desperately for some repair today?
Unfortunately, all three. And really, the issue beyond that is the technology issue. See, I'm really very pessimistic because it seems to me that if you look at history, the one thing you can never stop is the march of technology. You can sometimes channel it, you can sometimes make it better, but the fact is that both government and, what we forget, private business, and in a highly capitalist society, the two are really together. They're the same thing because that's the most powerful lobby of all. They have the technology, and they will use it. If you recall, France succeeded in saving 70% of its Jews during the war because somebody sabotaged a computer. The resistance sabotaged a computer. There were other reasons for it as well. France resisted much better than most people think. But the fact is that today, if you had a Hitler or a Stalin, nobody of any oppositional character would survive. It would be so easy to get it all. All it'll take is pushing a button. So the first thing I would say is that all three areas pointed out by Jennifer are obviously serious. I think, for instance, that the lobbying stuff is nonsense. In the name of transparency, they've made it difficult for people to call MPs or government officers or mayors or whatever. And does anybody seriously think that the very wealthy, the very powerful, need the lobbying app?
Julius, are you suggesting that prime ministers and premiers, when they go to the homes of the wealthy, who put out $5,400 checks, you mean they talk about something more than the weather and their children?
They talk about things in general. I mean,
of
if
course.
You were invited to a cocktail, you'd talk about things, and it would be an effective way of getting your view across. This particular, the lobbying legislation has the effect of preventing the middle from getting through to governments. For instance, you now have to hesitate before writing the Minister of Immigration if there is a real injustice. It's so cumbersome.
Even writing?
Even writing everything, you have to hesitate twice, and also you have to get past the privacy rules. You've got to get signatures from your clients who often can't, and so on. It's very difficult. So, first thing is, all three things have to be looked at. I would advise people, I certainly do not use email, etc., and the reason is that in a law firm, all information is sensitive. My clients, not only from a government point of view, most cases are private law cases, but there is somebody who's got access to internet, who's interested in insurance companies, business opponents, and so on. I use email and so on as little as possible, but even that is no solution because, they can get your faxes, they can, there are other ways of, telephone conversations are overheard. In the end, I think we're going to have to get a different mentality in our society, a less vindictive society, a society which will answer so what if somebody picks up, say, a politically incorrect telephone conversation. We're going to have a less viciously competitive society where there will be less to be gained by snooping on people and finding out that they don't have strictly orthodox views and that they have not had a completely Pollyannish life history and so on.
And that is a great and agonizing danger that Canadians will and do stick to the smug biases and prejudices, and they're willing to go with the flow just to avoid any scrutiny.
One of the terrible myths is that because our society is considered democratic, then, squealing in our society is different from squealing in previous societies.
Because supposedly we're doing it for a noble purpose.
And everything is right, and the laws must be obeyed to the letter because it's different. Well, let me tell you, I don't think it's terribly different. 90% of the laws in countries that are not technically democratic are also traffic laws, tax laws, things of that sort. And the righteousness of our society, coupled with the tremendous means put into the hands of government, and the fact that, in fact, there's been a loss of power on the part of the little guy and a transfer of power and wealth to the big guy over the last 10 or 15 years, means that our society is well on the way to becoming what I call a totalitarian democracy, a society which votes, and the votes are fairly counted, but apart from that, anybody in his right mind will not say anything unorthodox, will not certainly not write or put on internet anything that could possibly be used against them anywhere. Now, society in which people are going to be as cautious as, say, the citizens of East Germany were 25 years ago.
Julius, great. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Montreal, we want to hear from you. 790-0006. We'll be back with you right after this. Personal privacy and open government. How free are we is the issue. And our special guest right now is constitutional expert Julius Gray. And Julius, before we get to the question of, you know, are we mirroring in our security policies domestically what we're seeking to destroy abroad, I just want to take Brian, who has a very interesting point to make about those who are underprivileged in our society and how what kind of scrutiny they're under. Brian, welcome.
Hi, Mr. Gray. Julius Gray also.
Hi.
I find that I did some inquiring around, and I found that the legal aid system is not sufficient to protect people in this province because of the inquiring investigation that they're doing on people on behalf of what they call the government recovering and this is like an intertwined thing.
Brian, the government recovering what?
Well, in the case of people who are on welfare or people that who have gone from their jobs, lost their jobs, and waited to collect welfare, unemployment insurance, in that meantime that you were collecting, or you're waiting this retroactive business, that they would go after you for funds on welfare because they give you an emergency amount and they go after you for this exorbitant amount of money.
And did you find that they did it in an evasive way with you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. They told me that you have to pay and all this. All these threats are going out to people, not just me, but people that are underprivileged and worse.
But Montreal, I want to point out something. Brian brings up a very important point. And, Julius, we just had a file at the Institute on this with a young lady who had to be on welfare, and the government bureaucrats found out, she wasn't even aware of it, they found out that she had some shares in a company that weren't paying her hardly anything, like $36 a year, that her grandfather had left her, and they made her life a living hell, peppering her with letter after letter every week, wanting a clawback with penalties and interest for something she wasn't even aware she had.
The whole legal aid system is so inadequate that it's very little to be said. The system of justice fundamentally does not favor the little guy. That's why the belief that we can all get justice before the courts is false. Not because the courts are corrupt, they aren't, but because there is no way of getting to the courts. And furthermore, the means you have matter about how you prepare your case and so on, and so the big have a tremendous advantage in front of the courts, and there's very little to be done. That's another one of the myths of our society, that the little guy can win. In fact, in the United
States... A great myth, and I think this is an important point that Brian is making, Julius, that the little guy cannot afford, of course, the kind of legal care or legal representation that the rich can afford, but moreover, we have government departments that are going, particularly revenue, that when they talk about getting more revenues out of the public, they never go after the 40% of the corporations, for example, that have declared $1 million of profits or more a year, but they go after the taxi drivers, the waitresses, the construction workers.
Absolutely, but in terms of the court system and government, all the changes over the last 5 or 6 years have been terrible changes, which supposedly improved the quality of the justice system by speeding it up and so on, and the effect has been to make the gap between the little guy and the big guy even more. The system now favors the big guy, without being the least bit corrupted, favors the big guy in a tremendous way.
But is your vote actually equal to another person's vote if you live in a province like Quebec, where in fact there's 40% of the people that are under the poverty level? And the thing is, I know that the government is not really contentious when they say, well, you know, you can't trust that guy because he's going to take away your benefits. So people want to get off of the system because the system has become a forced march for people that are marching their ways to oblivion because there are no more workers in the same sense that the workers, the industrial workers.
No.
People are being put out of jobs.
No, but the Quebec political system is skewered simply by the national question. Unfortunately, so many people on both sides vote simply for or against sovereignty that they forget that that is such a minor issue compared to social justice and Medicare and so on. And the terrible thing in Quebec is that we can't get past that question.
Brian, we thank you very much. Julius, we'd ask you to stay with us. We'll be back right after this break.
I can't stay with you anymore. I've got to go, so.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
So we thank you, too. Montreal, I'll be back with you right after this. From welfare recipients to the most powerful, the culture of suspicion and secrecy that has bred some of the most smug biases affects everyone. Our next guest was affected at the most powerful end of the spectrum. And we welcome to our show Gwynne Morgan. Mr. Morgan, thank you for joining us today.
Good to be here.
Gwynne Morgan was voted in 2005 as Canada's most respected CEO, vice chair of Canada, and Canada Energy, Canada's largest independent oil and gas corporation. Mr. Morgan had agreed that to serve as a dollar-a-year man, prime minister, as chair of the Appointments Commission. And he went through a sometimes brutal process with the Commons Committee, with the committee really not looking at his credentials or abilities to serve, but taking him to task for politically correct or politically incorrect statements that he had made. Mr. Morgan, how do you feel after all that process? Have we just become a country that's so sclerotic we can't accept the truth when it's spoken to us, as Harry Truman would have said, plain speaking like you did?
Well, I guess in some ways we have. And I think, one of the speeches I was attacked on was titled Getting to Root Causes, What the Politicians Are Afraid to Say. And I guess the bottom line is that when it comes to politics, we have to stick to what has become the lowest common denominator of political correctness instead of really getting at the root causes of the problems we face. What's really been interesting since and by the way, it was the opposition parties that took me on, not the...
Yes, it was a 6-5 vote in the committee.
Yeah,
it was strictly partisan.
And, but you know, the bottom line is that since this occurred, I've had overwhelming support from across the country. I've never had, in all of my years, including being voted CEO of the Year and so on, I've never had such support. And one of the reasons is that people are looking. I think people across the country are looking for ways in which we can get to the root causes and talk about them, not in terms of attacking anyone, but in terms of dealing with the issues.
And dealing with productive policies. One of the things that amazed me was they attacked you for suggesting that we reassess our immigration policies in terms of violence, violent crime, in terms of our security needs. When Ambassador Martin Collicott of the Fraser Institute's groundbreaking report on Canada's inadequate response to terror made the same points across the country and was lauded for it. So it was just amazing that the Ottawa Beltway, it hasn't sunk in there.
Well, nothing I said was new. Everything I said had already been said by others, and a lot of it came from police reports and so on. But I guess the bottom line is that people like to brand people. And
make political capital out of it.
And make political capital out of it. I mean, I'm a person who has traveled in some 60 countries in the world. I've got my wife and I actually support people and some students from different parts of the world in terms of their education. We are pro-immigration. But what we are also is saying, let's not import violence. Let's import people that will contribute to our society. And our screening systems have been awful in that regard. And then we have people who commit grievous crimes that are still here 10 years later trying to get them out of the country, and I'm saying that's not the right thing.
When you go through an experience like this, how does our federal government get the best and the brightest?
How do we get what?
When someone like you goes through an experience like this, how does our federal government get the best and the brightest? I mean, you were doing this in the tradition of you know, the finest people who served this country at a dollar a year, volunteering your time, and this just put a bad taste in everybody's mouth.
Well, it was interesting. You know, I wrote a letter, I wrote a column for the Globe on this, and I think I called it, right after the experience, I called it Don't Be Deterred. And what I was really getting at was that I had really believed, maybe somewhat idealistically, that there are people in the country who have done well in their various fields, whether it be in my case business or in medicine or research or any other area, who at some point in their life have gone through the most intense part and ready to give back in a different way. And so I was very keen on creating this dollar-a-year process, and I'd actually recruited other commissioners, by the way, of various political stripes and backgrounds across the country, who also had agreed to do the same, to give their time and effort for a dollar a year. And I thought if we could show this kind of people coming out of the various walks of life and coming in and helping the country, if we could show that to be a positive experience, this could be a cascading effect. Unfortunately, of course, it has had the opposite effect, and the purpose of my column was to say, look, let's not make six members of the opposition who aren't farsighted enough to see what was at stake there, kill that dream. I'm not prepared to give up on that dream yet.
The cause endures and the dream shall never die. Mr. Morgan, I know your time is tight, and we thank you for taking time to speak with us.
Thank you.
Take care. Enjoy. Montreal, we'll be right back. Montreal, we're examining personal privacy and open government and just how free are we. We have Peter on the line. Welcome, Peter.
Yeah, hi, Burl. You know, it's tough when it comes to obvious security concerns. We have to have a very vigilant government. But, you know, the point you're making, too, about protecting individual privacy, there's a point about how the Quebec government protects its own privacy. And I don't think too many people know this. And this is an example how when government wants...
At the bureaucratic and political level.
Exactly. Well, I'm thinking particularly at the political level in this case.
The elected level.
I just wanted to share this, with the listeners. For example, you know, a member of parliament in Quebec, or I should say a member of the legislature...
National Assembly.
Yeah, in Quebec, provincial assembly, is elected. We have 125 of them elected in Quebec. Now... Each one gets a budget. They have, of course, their salary, they have money for office expenses, but they also have something called a discretionary budget. It amounts to about $80,000 to $100,000 a year. Now, this money comes from the taxpayer's coffers. We pay for it. We elect the MNA. We give him our tax dollars to do this. He has this discretionary, say, $100,000. He can do whatever he wants with it. He can put anybody on a payroll. He can give a gift to whomever, whatever, and there's no way of tracing this. It is against the law in Quebec. The privacy law protects that MNA and the National Assembly from having to disclose where that money goes. And, you know, this is one thing that, now this may, you know, I don't want to overstate this because I think this is probably just a drop in the bucket in terms of, you know, potentially corrupt areas. But what bothers me about this is, you know, you could have a member of parliament who's got somebody on his payroll, be it a journalist, a public official, who knows, whatever he may be, you know, and this money can't be traced. It just creates... and I'm not saying they're all dirty. I'm just saying it just creates a lack of confidence.
It raises the question because it's not something that we as citizens have a right to, and if we as citizens ever did that, we'd be under immediate suspicion. And to underline your point, by the way, one of the largest amounts of money that the Quebec government on the bureaucratic level holds that is not subject to scrutiny is in the public curator's office, where some $250 million is not subject to the auditor general.
It's incredible. You know, there's a potential there. And of course, we have to have confidence in our government. I mean, you know, it's like the stock market. It's like...
We don't have to have confidence. We can keep them under scrutiny. We can push their buttons.
We have to have confidence, but we have to keep them under scrutiny. As Ronald Reagan said, trust but verify. You know, what I mean is when I say we have to have confidence, I mean, a system really needs that to work well. But it's not a blind trust. I'm not confusing confidence with blind trust. Of course, we have to scrutinize them because, I mean, if something can go wrong, often it will.
But, you know, we have to do it. The citizens have to do it. As Jennifer Stoddard said, you pick up the phone, you call your MNAs, you call your MPs. We don't always need commissions and tribunals to do it. We can do it. They work for us. Your tax dollars pays these guys.
Absolutely. But the average person, you know, look at Quebec's language laws. English-speaking people get, and non-French-speaking people get kicked around, and even some French-speaking people, because, you know, if they want the choice, freedom of choice, anyone who believes in freedom of choice, they get kicked around by the language laws. The politicians get away with it. The society gets away with it, you know,
the laid-back, silent majority.
The unpleasant powers that be, yeah, exactly, gets away with these. Another compromise on freedom of expression. When something so visible as that right to freedom is compromised, what about all the other rights? I mean, well, governments get a hint. You know,
you're quite right. And Peter, I invite you to call back a little later in the show. We'll be talking with Brent Tyler on his challenge to Quebec's Bill 104. Thank you for the call.
He's an excellent guy. I'm glad you have him on the show.
He'll be on shortly.
I'll be listening. Thank you.
And I welcome you to call you back, that you call back. And right now we're going to Washington, and we welcome Scott Shane. Scott, welcome. Thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Shane is a reporter for the New York Times and the Washington Bureau and has written a very compelling article on how government in the United States invokes what's called a secrets privilege as a popular legal tactic. And we're going to come back with him right after this and discuss how that actually is reflected and mirrored in Canada. We'll be right back. We've been examining our personal privacy and open government. How free are we? And we've taken it from the level of the welfare recipient who is abused in every corner of his life, all the way up to government officials who have to face the most smug kind of biases. Now we're getting to the third level of government executive privilege, and our special guest is Scott Shane, Washington correspondent for the New York Times. And I just want to read the opening paragraph of a very compelling story that Scott wrote. Facing a wave of litigation challenging its eavesdropping at home and its handling of terror suspects abroad, the Bush administration is increasingly turning to a legal tactic that swiftly torpedoes most lawsuits, the state secrets privilege. Scott, could you explain the state secrets privilege? And then I want to talk to you about how it's mirrored here.
Sure. The state secrets privilege was established by a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 1953, known as the Reynolds case, in which the court said that within some limits, basically, if the executive branch says that something is too secret to look into, the executive branch can block a lawsuit. And this was used very sparingly in the 50s and 60s, increasingly in the 70s, and the current administration, the Bush administration, has used it more frequently than any previous administration, basically as a tactic to block lawsuits involving national security matters.
Now, as I understand it, in the United States, in order to block something, the government would actually have to go in front of a judge.
The government would have to go in front of a judge, and in some cases, the judges look over in camera without the other side knowing secret material and satisfies himself or herself that there really are sensitive secrets involved and that the lawsuit must be stopped. In some cases, the judges appear to simply take the government's word for it. But in general, when the government has invoked this legal doctrine, it has stopped the lawsuit cold.
But in theory and in practice, there has to be that recourse to the court. We in Canada, and this is the parallel I want to make, and I want our listeners to get this very, very well, we have something called security certificates, where our government, on executive order, can hold anyone on national security grounds, without charge, and we've had people held for up to 3 years, without a judge. Now, does the secrets privilege go that far in the United States as we have it in Canada?
Well, they're sort of in different areas. The state secrets privilege in the U.S. is used to block civil litigation and not has not been used in criminal cases. In fact, in criminal cases that involve secrets, there's a special provision where the defense attorney is given a clearance and some information remains secret, but a criminal case can go ahead. In the case of civil lawsuits involving secrets, this doctrine can be used to stop them outright. There's nothing quite comparable to a security certificate, but of course, under this administration, people have been charged as enemy combatants and held in Guantanamo and other places with no trial and with minimal recourse to the court.
But not Americans. In Canada, we have Canadians, people on our territory who've been held under security certificates.
Yeah, there have been actually a couple of U.S. citizens involved in those situations, but you're right, generally speaking, they've been foreign citizens arrested overseas.
Scott, we invite you to stay with us. We'll be back with you right after this break. We're talking about personal privacy and open government. How free are we? And with us is Scott Shane, Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Scott, I don't know if you overheard the news while you were waiting, but we're discussing the problems of state secret privilege, one of the stories in the newscast here was that some tobacco inspector is going to fine a store for $2,000 for selling matchbooks with the word tobacco on it. So, you know, we go from the mundane to the ridiculous. In your report, you mentioned the case of Maher Arar, right now the Arar inquiry in Canada. It's big news. Is there any news that have come out as to why the Americans detained him and sent him to Syria instead of back to Canada, or is that part of the thing that's covered by the secrets privilege and there's been no information coming out on it?
Actually, in the Arar case, which I wrote about last year, it remains a little bit murky as to why the Americans grabbed him, but what I was told last year was that his arrest at Kennedy Airport as he was changing planes, a route he'd chosen ironically because he had frequent flyer miles and could fly that way more cheaply through New York,
right.
apparently turned up on a watch list, and they made a decision that they wanted to question him further. And somebody's idea was that because he'd been born in Syria, they could send him to Syria and the Syrians could question him.
Even though he was a Canadian citizen.
Even though he was a Canadian citizen, they could legally deport him. It was a little bit different from the other cases of rendition, as our government calls it, in that this was technically an immigration action that was not carried out strictly in secret. There is paperwork documenting it. And he was technically deported to his country of birth, which was Syria, where, of course, as you know, he was says that he was tortured and held in a tiny cell for many months. There is no one in the U.S. government that I've talked to who now defends that action or who argues that Arar actually had any terrorist connections. But when Mara Arar filed a lawsuit against the U.S. government to try to shed a little light on what happened to him and get compensation, the government again raised this state secrets privilege issue, and the at the trial court level, the lawsuit was thrown out essentially at the very beginning of the process on grounds that are similar to but slightly separate from the state secrets privilege, and that case is on appeal now.
The suggestion has been made by one lawyer that the original Reynolds decision that you explained started the state secrets privilege, that the facts in the case, the facts from the Air Force, were wrong. Any chance that there'll be an appeal of that original decision?
Well, that's a very interesting question. There is actually a case in which the state secrets privilege is getting a little bit of more scrutiny than it usually gets. It's one of the American Civil Liberties Union lawsuits against the American National Security Agency's domestic eavesdropping program.
Right.
The ACLU claims that that program is illegal and has filed suit. And the government has claimed state secrets privilege, said we can't go ahead with this lawsuit because it will endanger national security. And a judge has rebuffed that, at least at the initial stage, and has agreed next week to have a hearing in that case. So that's a possibility that somewhere there the state secrets privilege may get another look. As you said, the Reynolds case on which the whole doctrine was built from 1953, in that case it involved the crash of a plane and survivors of those killed in the crash filing suit. The government said they couldn't get the accident report because it contained secrets about the mission that this plane was on and about secret equipment that was being used. Finally, many years later, those papers were declassified and turned out to neither have secrets about the mission nor secrets about equipment. But the legal doctrine remains in place.
So layers of secrets upon layers of secrets and a bodyguard of lies. Scott Shane, Washington correspondent for the New York Times, we thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And for taking the time. Take care. Montreal, we'll be right back after this. Well, Montreal, we've been talking about the invasion of our personal domains, the invasion of privacy rights, and when our rights are rights are rights. Not rights. And our next guest, lawyer Brent Tyler, certainly knows what it means to have rights chipped away at over and over again. And Brent Tyler, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
When one of our callers earlier, when he heard you were going to be on, said, you know, one of the things that he considers his private domain that's been chipped away at are the language policies of Quebec. And we thought that the whole sclerotic neuroses were over. But now you're facing another challenge of Bill 104, restricting Bill 101, and hurting people yet again in their ordinary lives. And perhaps you could take a minute to talk about the St. Laurent family. I mean, this is Orwellian to the max.
Well, the Bill 104 purports to disregard, Beryl, instruction received in a private institution or instruction received pursuant to a special authorization. And the effect of that is to prevent parents. For example, a child can have gone from grade 1 to grade 6 in an English private school and want to continue in the same school, but because the high school accepts subsidies, they're not able to do that. And so that's an example of an extreme effect of the law. And so, of course, we're hoping that the Court of Appeal will strike it down. We can avoid situations which are patently unjust. You know.
And why did the government need this restriction?
Well, they felt that there would, because there was an increase in the applications, there is, if you look at the stats, an increase of people that were availing themselves of this possibility of invoking private instruction to then get subsidized instruction. And the government felt that if they didn't do something, that it would turn into a much greater problem. But when you look at the stats in perspective, when you consider that just over 5,000 children were able to avail themselves over the years, and that's the cumulative total since 1982 when the Charter of Rights and Freedoms was first adopted. There's no damage to the linguistic equilibrium that the government seems to be worried about.
As a matter of fact, the latest numbers show that the French is certainly not under any threat, and that even Francophones want their children to have the opportunity to engage in the North American economy and learn English.
There's no question. I mean, when you look at the polls, between 71% and 81% of Quebecers, of all linguistic and ethnic backgrounds included, when they're asked the question point blank, would you like to be able to choose a language of instruction of your children, they say yes, between, you know, that order of magnitude. Now, that includes a majority of Francophones, a lot of Péquist voters, and so it, to me, what it shows is there's a sort of a radical disconnect between the elite consensus, which supposedly exists in favor of this law, and the actual opinion of Quebecers on the ground. But that's not unusual, as you know, Beryl. I mean, sometimes the elites are just out to lunch, and the guy in the street has it right. I think that's an example of that.
Are the elites just using this as another sacred cow? I mean, obviously the PQ elites are, but when are they? Is anybody out there saying it's time to grow up?
Well, I think what we're all dealing with here is this sense among many Francophones of linguistic insecurity. I mean, as a phenomenon, it's hard to deny that there is this fairly widespread sentiment that their language is vulnerable. There's that perception. But when you look at the empirical evidence, the reality, 82% of the population of Quebec speaks French. French is their mother tongue. It hasn't changed in 50 years. And in the same period, there's been an increase in Quebec of 2.4 million Francophones.
But is there no compassionate authority that would allow an 11-year-old brother to join his sister?
Well, you see,
I mean, are these just bureaucrats run wild?
Well, this is them applying the law, and this is the problem with Bill 104.
But as Lord Acton said, law without the equity of just consideration is just dry paper.
Well, I couldn't...
And you've been fighting the good fight for so long, is it sinking into any of the bureaucrats?
Well, I think it's going to take another court judgment or two to answer your question. I think that, unfortunately, the minister took the judgment of the Supreme Court in the Salty case rendered in March of last year and turned it upside down, and where the court clearly intended to enlarge access, they're using the Salsky judgment to justify restricting access even further. So there's no question that the Quebec government has been moving the yardsticks, changing the rules of the game since the Charter of the French Language was first adopted.
Brent, I would ask you to stay with us. I'm welcoming Brian, who I know I wanted to have a word with you. Welcome, Brian. And I'd ask, Brian, are you on the line? Brian?
Peter.
Oh, Peter, sorry.
Yeah.
We just got a message here to Brian. So, Peter, Brent, stay with us. We'll be right back with you after this.
Thank you.
We're talking about personal privacy, open government. How free are we, and what are our rights? Brent Tyler on the line with us, constitutional lawyer, making another challenge on language laws, and Peter's on the line. Peter, welcome back.
Yes, hi, thanks. First of all, it's like people say, hey, there are no honest lawyers out there. You said Brent Tyler's fighting a good fight, Beryl, and I agree. I think the guy's worth his weight in gold and more.
Brent, is this the president of your fan club?
Ringer. Yeah, no. I just read the papers.
But you're quite right.
And I saw Brent on as well. I was watching the History Channel, and there was a documentary they had on Bill 101. It was produced by someone with the CBC years ago, or still. Anyway, Brent was one of the people interviewed. Now, he was, he was a minority voice. And the point that I got from this documentary, you know, it's like they were all excusing Bill 101 and saying, well, it's necessary to save Canada, and it helped fight separation and all that. And I don't think they gave Brent enough time on that show. I'd like to know what he thinks of that argument.
Well, Peter, it wouldn't be the first time that you've seen that theory expressed by Anglo elites, this idea that we have to trade rights for national unity, that if we insist on the same rights and freedoms as are enjoyed by people around the world, that somehow would constitute a threat to the very existence of the country. And I think the question that we now have to ask is that what kind of a country do we have? You know, we have Stanley and Muriel Reed, who were prosecuted for selling maple syrup on an English-only website when their clientele that they're targeting is English Canadians and Americans. And I could go on and on with countless examples. But this idea that Stanley and Muriel Reed have to have their rights infringed to somehow keep the country together is the presumption of the elites, and in my opinion, it is exactly the wrong way to go. Rights are like a muscle. If you don't use them, you'll lose them. And, you know, it's thanks to people like Stanley and Muriel Reed that the issue hasn't gone away. And you know something? It'll never go away as long as there are people like them that are prepared to stand up and assert their rights.
The most remarkable thing about elites, Brent, is we've recently had, not even that recently, just 5 years ago, had the debates of the Bourassa government, the second Bourassa government in 1974 after he won his second election, on the original language laws. And those cabinet debates themselves, you see these ministers saying, well, yeah, the French language isn't really any threat, but, you know, if we make this law, it'll reduce separatist sentiment. And it was a machination of a manipulation of public opinion for no reason, because 2 years later they lost the election anyway.
You're absolutely right. And perhaps what's even equally egregious is that when the Canadian Charter was patriated in 1982, they could have enshrined freedom of choice for Canadian citizens. Instead, they chose basically the same regime that existed under Bill 101, the language of the parent. The only difference was that it was in Canada instead of Quebec, a very minor modification. The point being that, you know, Greta Chambers called that in 1992 a delayed but deliberate death sentence. And fast forward to now, you know, the English Montreal School Board closed 6 schools last year. Lester B. Pearson is going through a massive reorganization. School enrollment is starting again to decline. And so we have to ask ourselves, you know, where is the federal government in all of this? Where is the opposition? The Liberals in Quebec, Beryl, they voted for Bill 104. You know, this it was a unanimous vote.
Unanimous vote of the National Assembly.
That's right.
Brent, you asked the right question. Where are our political elites? And I want you to stay on the line as I sign off, because I'm going to do something that in this insane country is not legal. We're naturally, we're an English network, so you can't do an interview in French. Let me try a quote in French from the great writer Bertrand de Jouvenel, who wrote, La démocratie, telle que nous l'avons pratiquée, apparaît donc comme la période d'incubation de la tyrannie de la médiocratie. Democracy, he wrote, the way we're practicing it appears nothing more than a period of incubation for the tyranny of the mediocre. And I hope that will not be the epitaph for this experiment in this great northern dominion. Brent Tyler, thank you for joining us. Thank you, callers.
My pleasure, Beryl.
Thank you, Val Prudnikoff, Chris Smith, our operator, Montrealers, Canadians, get on the phones, assert your rights. Rights are rights are rights. Let's take our country back. See you next week.